Hello, everyone. This is Chander in Palo Alto. And today I have a very special guest and a friend, Matt Papakipos, who is currently based out of Amsterdam. And I'm very lucky to have him as a guest on our podcast. And I think he's the first or second guest this year. The previous one was Andrew Sherrard, former chief marketing officer at T-Mobile. And today we have Matt, who has a, you know, when you hear about the Silicon Valley, one of the things you normally hear is paying it forward, meaning, you know, help others without expecting anything. And then when you get a chance to help, then you help somebody else. That's how the cycle works. So Matt is an exemplar of that. I've experienced it firsthand in my, when I co-founded a company, he made so many introductions to people who were very helpful with strategy, product dev, without expecting anything. And now, you know, he's back again helping me with the podcast without expecting anything. So when you hear about paying it forward, Matt is an exemplar of living that every day. So thank you, Matt, for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Chander.
And he's also one of the few people I met here in Silicon Valley who's actually from Silicon Valley. He grew up in Palo Alto. I would let him tell the story. His mom was one of the first software engineers in the Valley. So, Matt, why don't we start with growing up in Silicon Valley? How was it like, and how did you decide to get into tech?
Sure. So I grew up with my mom talking about all the cool startup companies she was working at. So we came out to California as a family in 1983 because my mom was chasing a startup in
1983. 83.
Wow. Really before? I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. So grew up in Concord, Mass. So East Coast. And then, yeah, she came out here in 83. So we came out in 83 because she was joining a startup here. And so we lived in Palo Alto, moved into a house in Palo Alto. And within a year and a half, the company went out of business. very Silicon Valley. Yeah. And so she discovered like how cool Silicon Valley is as a place to work in tech. And so worked at a series of different companies. Did a lot of software engineering herself. I got really inspired by all the technology and the weird computers that she would bring home and leave around the house. And started coding when I was at the age of 7, just because the computers were everywhere. So
coding at the age of 7. So give us an example. Like, what was she bringing at home?
The first weird thing she brought home was a PDP-8E, which doesn't even have a screen or a keyboard. That was pretty weird. It's just LEDs and switches. So that was a very strange machine that I really just like played around with mostly. But then we got, I don't remember what the computer was, but I remember in those days, the way that you would program is, this is going to sound hilarious, but like she had this thing that was basically a printer with a keyboard on the front of it. Right. And so it was a terminal. So you could call into some other computer and then use it as a terminal, which sounds ridiculous. So literally, instead of having a screen, it's printing on paper as you type. So everything you type is being printed on the screen. It's actually kind of cool because when you want to scroll back, you just reach behind the printer and it was on these big sheets, like continuous sheets. Do you remember these things?
Yeah.
It was these continuous sheets with perforations. So you could pull off an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper from it. But it was inherently just a bunch of sheets with these little holes on the edge. So
that was the dot matrix printer.
Exactly. And yeah. So you could, like, if you wanted to go back 10 screens, you'd just reach behind the printer and pull up the pile of paper and look for the thing that happened that you were looking for. those are the computers that I grew up programming on, was those weird things.
Wow. Well, I have two things to say. One, think about what we complain about now. You know, the iPhone is not fast enough, or it's like taking 3 microseconds, or like how things have changed.
Yeah, not even having a proper screen on your computer was pretty bad. Yeah. Even at the time, it seemed kind of bad. Yeah. But yeah, my mom was very inspiring. And so she'd bring home all these weird computers. That's how I first learned to program, definitely caught the bug for how exciting it was to program and do software and do mathematics. And her career was really inspiring. By the time I was in high school, she was running big projects at tech companies. But probably the most exciting was Silicon Graphics, which was a tech behemoth of the day, which was making some of the first computers that you could, you know, have sitting next to your desk that could do graphics and audio and video and stuff like that. So again, it sounds ridiculous now, but back in the early 80s, that was a really big deal to have a computer with a screen and a keyboard that could do video and audio and editing and 3D graphics was amazing. And so my mom ran this project at Silicon Graphics building a machine called the Indigo, which was one of the first machines that really packaged all this stuff together in a computer that cost less than $15,000, which sounds really expensive today, but it was a huge breakthrough at the time. Tremendous. And it's exciting too to see my mom running this as a woman, right, in a company that is frankly almost entirely filled with men. But she was inspiring. She's amazing. She's still inspiring and amazing. And she's throughout my career, she's always the one I would call to say, like, help me with the salary negotiation, help me with the politics work. Like, it's cool. Having someone like that in your family is amazing.
Yeah, so, I think it inspired you. I think people who are listening, it'll inspire them as well, because, you know, there's a debate happening in the Valley how women are not getting, you know, equal pay or not enough jobs are going to women. So it's good to see an example where women led big projects, inspired their children to get into tech. And even, isn't she working with you on your new startup?
She wrote some of the networking code for the robot that I'm working on these days, which is kind of crazy because she's in her 70s now, but she's still got it. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about the new startup. What is your new startup?
So I've been working on the startup for a few years now, a robotics startup, which is very exploratory. Call it Pied Piper Robotics, really just kind of a working name. But the I've been trying to figure out how are home robots going to happen? So it's very early. It's still, you know, I think a ways off, honestly, until most of us are going to see any kind of interesting robots in the home. You know, today I have a Roomba, or one of the Roomba competitors, in my home here. Mm-hmm. And it's cool. I love having this robot, but it's really rough, right? Like, twice a day it breaks down. I have to clean the roller. And it's not just emptying the dustbin. It breaks down in pretty impressive ways where you have to, like, go pull an iPhone cable out of its vacuum mechanism. And it's semi-destroyed itself. Had to send it in for service already a couple times. You know, home robots are in an early stage. So Pied Piper is really tinkering around with that, trying to figure out, when is that going to happen? What are the first use cases that are going to be possible aside from light vacuuming? When does that really happen? And it's early days is the main thing I would say. It's still a ways off in general. The main challenges I'm seeing in the field so far is cost. It's really expensive. Cost and reliability. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really expensive. The unit I've made is much more expensive than I would like it to be. It's too expensive to sell to consumers yet. It's almost as much as a car to build one, which is crazy. And I would say reliability is the other big problem. I mean, you see this with Roomba, with the robotic vacuums all the time. They just get stuck all the time. And it's comical. This morning, actually, my wife and I were running around our apartment trying to figure out, where is it? Like, it's stuck somewhere. We don't know where. Finally found it under a curtain behind a chair, actually, the one that I'm sitting in. I don't know why it was stuck either. Like, I'm a roboticist and I couldn't really figure out why it was stuck. It seemed like it should have been able to get out of there, but it couldn't. And that's tough, right? If I love my robotic vacuum cleaner, but I wouldn't leave with it on when I went on vacation because I know it wouldn't make it more than a day, which is a sad statement. So it's still early days for home robotics, but that's what I've been looking into.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, it's such an interesting area. So the main reason we wanted Matt on the podcast is, you know, after he finished working in Silicon Valley, he moved to Seoul, then he moved to Paris briefly, and now he's been in Amsterdam over a year. So we want to see how the startup scene is different in all these places. But let's continue with robotics. It's so interesting first. So what's the, like, I would say a lot of the autonomous car stuff is kind of robotics related.
Totally. Yeah, they're robots.
Like, you know, there we see a lot of progress. So can something from there move to home, which is a more contained environment? You can actually make a list of most of the scenarios inside the home for, let's say, a vacuum cleaner.
So will that technology come into the home? I mean, I don't know. I'd actually back up for a second and say, you know, it's kind of instructive looking at what's been going on with autonomous cars, right? Like, it's been a pretty bumpy road, right? Waymo's been around for 10 years now. I think all of us assumed 5 years ago that this was just around the corner, right? It's felt like 5 years ago, I felt like it was just going to be a year or two and we were going to start seeing these things. It's been a long, bumpy road for them, right? It's, you know, we've seen valuations get marked down for a bunch of those companies recently. Like, so I think there's a lot of reasons to be cautious actually in robotics right now. Like, there's a lot of excitement. Everyone wants it to happen. We all want to have, I think home robots would be really cool. Like, I'd like to have a robot do my dishes, wash my clothes. But I think that stuff's all really still pretty far away. And I think that's what we're seeing with cars too, is I think it's further away than most people thought, even people in the field. And so I think it's going to be a while for a lot of that. We're making good progress, right? Yeah. Robotics is in way better shape than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but it's not really quite at the breakthrough stage yet. I think we're still going to see cool innovations, but I think it'll be a while before we really see home robots or even autonomous cars in any widespread way.
What do you think people missed? Like, they thought they're right around the corner, and then what did people miss that it didn't happen?
I think it's the classic computer science thing of it's really hard to estimate how long hardware and software projects take, right? It's so easy to get to 90% and then realize that the last 10% actually takes 10 times longer. It's really, really hard to predict completion for a brand new product in a brand new field. And this is a really hard field. And it's not hard with a robot to quickly get to the something that works 80% good, but getting that last 10 or 20% is really, really hard. So and with cars, right, you have to get that last 10 or 20% or you're killing people. Yeah. And even with home robots, right, you're, you know, if you're, you know, ripping down the curtains in the house or even, you know, not doing the chores, it's there are consequences.
Is it mainly like covering the corner cases? Like the last 10% is what? The things we have not thought of, the model cannot understand, or...
Well, a good example for my robot is, right, I have this little robot that's a little bit like a dog. It kind of cruises around the house. The biggest problem I have is what people in robotics call the long-term autonomy problem, which is that it's not hard to make a robot that can be autonomous in a closed space for a long time, but there's always a time after which it will get stuck. And no one really knows how to solve this problem, right? The long-term autonomy, can I make it autonomous for a long period of time? No one really can do that. And it's there's no single one thing that breaks down, but there's always something that breaks down. And the problem is once it's stuck, it's stuck. So you can't really do much about it. I mean, people do things where they try to put in like a, can I put in a thing to help it stand up again after it falls over? Well, there's always a way it can fall over where that thing doesn't work anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So that's an example. It's the long-term autonomy problem. Yep.
And now with these, you know, machine learning models, I think in old days, we didn't have as much, you know, self-learning by the machines, which we have that now. So if you're making something static in a dynamic environment, you know, eventually it'll fail. But now we can make something dynamic in a dynamic environment that may learn with the environment.
Yeah, and my robot does that, and it's really cool. One of the things I'm most proud of with the robot is you don't need to give it a map of your house. You just put it down, and it figures it out, and it's pretty good at the maps. Like, that all just works, which is kind of amazing, right? It really does learn the shape of your house and where the rooms are and where the doors are and all that. It's very doable, but it doesn't stop it from getting stuck.
Yeah, it's stuck. Yeah, these are interesting problems.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm sure we'll make progress on it, but it's not quite as right around the corner as I think we'd all hoped.
Yeah. Well, that gives startups opportunity to, you know, create new things.
Yep.
So I think we'll have you back just to talk about robotics. So let's go to the go back to Silicon Valley. You were at Google in its early days. So tell us, how is that like? You know, now, like, two companies where you have spent a lot of time are Google and Facebook. They're both leaders in the world. And, you know, billions of people use these products, which actually has not happened before. And you saw them in early stages. So I want to, you know, understand, how was it like in early days at Google? Then how was it like at Facebook? Then what were the differences in how they operate?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, they're both really cool companies, and I really enjoyed working at both of them. And they were both really different than the ones that came before it, too. I would say prior to Google, like, there was a certain style of management for all the tech companies in Silicon Valley, whether it was Silicon Graphics or you know. And I think Google really changed a lot of how tech companies were managed by, this is going to sound weird, but making it more like a university and less like a company. And part of that was giving people a lot more freedom, a lot more perks, you know, the fancy meals, a lot of trust, a lot of ability for people to set their own direction, you know, start new projects, things like that. Frankly, quite a bit of chaos. Mm-hmm. And I think it was really good for Silicon Valley. It really shook things up, right? Like, to everybody in the other companies, it looked crazy. But it's actually worked for a really long period of time, and some amazing stuff has come out of Google, right? Google Search, clearly, but also Gmail, the Waymo self-driving car stuff. I mean, it may not be done yet, but it's still very impressive. Mm-hmm. You know, their whole system by which they run millions of jobs on this huge compute cluster, right? Like, mm-hmm. now everyone does that, like Amazon, but Google really paved the way for a lot of that, right?
Yeah.
I think they were the first company with 1 million servers running in Silicon Valley, which was pretty cool. I mean, today everyone's blown way past that, but I remember back in the day, it was pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. So I think, Google is, I would say, in a lot of ways, felt very academic to me. It felt like being back at university, and people call it that. People call it the Google campus, because that's the vibe.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool, and I think that freedom and innovation has served them actually really well. And sometimes it looks very chaotic and a little crazy, but I think it's worked out pretty well so far.
And then from there, you went to Facebook.
Yep.
How was that different than Google?
That's a good question. I think Facebook is less, it doesn't have that, like, it's a university, it's wild and crazy kind of feel. It's got lots of strengths, but that's not really kind of the vibe. I would say it's a much more top-down, strategically managed company. And it's always felt a lot smaller. It is smaller in terms of numbers, even today, at their current scale, but it's always felt like a much smaller company. And more focused, I would say, in a lot of ways, too. Less wild and crazy, less crazy new directions. Some of that happens at Facebook, but mostly I would say, actually a more traditionally managed, a bit more top-down. And to their credit, very strategic thinking, right? They are very bold about sort of placing big bets when they want to, whether it's about VR or competing with TikTok or acquiring Instagram. Like, they take some pretty bold steps that are outside their comfort zone, which is very different than Google. I would say Google tends to be more driven by technology. Facebook is driven a lot more by strategy and a bit more top down.
Mm.
And they both have their merits, right? They're producing different kinds of systems, different results.
Yeah. And they're also, we cover these companies in our podcast. So I saw, Facebook's operating margins are 32%. Google is like almost half of that.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah, like 19%. And it's pretty, some of the businesses are similar, you know, the ad, Facebook is mainly ads, and yep. Google is, you know, now cloud, YouTube ads and search ads and some other stuff. I don't know why that is, but it seems like if you have more freedom to do whatever you want, then that costs more money, and that may not result in something that produces revenue or income.
I think that's right. I haven't looked specifically at the margin difference, but I think part of it too may be that Google is now removing those businesses and new business areas from Google proper, right, from Alphabet. Yeah. So some of the more innovative stuff like Waymo, I mean, the truth though is that's going to be a drag on margins for a long time, as it should be, right? It's still early days.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah, I think that is a good example of like Facebook being more focused, right? They're a margins focused like company doing a handful of projects. Google's doing a lot of stuff. It doesn't surprise me their margins might be a little lower. They're both really successful companies, so I don't think one is right and one is wrong. They're different.
They're different.
And they're running at different scales. Google is a lot bigger in terms of people and scope.
Yeah, you're right. The efficiencies may decline with revenue or scale. I think Facebook has like 50,000 something employees. Google might be 80 or, I don't know, 100. I don't remember. How many were there when you were there? Number of employees at Google, Facebook?
I mostly think about number of engineers, so I don't really know the total headcount. But when I was joining Google, I want to say it was like 1,500-ish engineers because my company was acquired by Google. Facebook, when I joined, I want to say it was less than 200 engineers. So, yeah, but that said, like a lot of the staff at Facebook, for example, and Google is not engineers, right? It's all the other stuff, right? Of which there's a lot, right? There's a lot of people who work at Facebook helping companies figure out how to make their Facebook site and, you know, how to make their page look good, how to run their ad campaign. There's a lot. Most of the people who work at Facebook aren't in engineering, right?
Yeah.
By a wide margin. And that was true even when I got there, right? Even when I got there with a couple hundred engineers, there were thousands of people at the company.
Oh, that's interesting. So you would say Google is more engineer heavy than Facebook.
Well, no, sorry. I was just saying the numbers, how many engineers worked at each company when I arrived there. That was more about how old is the company, honestly.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I don't know the numbers for sure, but I think it makes sense that Google has more engineers as percentage of more employees than Facebook because of the business they're in. You're right. You know, the ad system in Google is auction based, so you don't have to do a lot of hand holding.
And Google doesn't, right? Facebook does a lot of hand holding to help people make ad campaigns. I don't think Google does nearly as much of that. Yeah.
Okay, so now let's go to. So you decided to leave Facebook, and then you decided to go to Seoul. So tell us about how that happened and why you chose Seoul of all the places in the world.
That's a great question. I can't claim it was any great, amazing plan. My youngest daughter wanted to go to Seoul to do a gap year to study the Korean language. And so my wife and I, at the time, were both working at home and decided to tag along. That's the honest answer. So it wasn't any amazing strategy decision. Seoul's an amazing market. I need to go do investing there. It was just I had a family reason to do it. And I was interested in the culture and the people because I'd visited Seoul before, but it was a bit random. Mm-hmm. So what my wife and I did is created a small investment company. And so we decided to invest in 5 startups and we were going to be there for a year during my daughter's gap year. And so we found ourselves in Seoul with a checkbook ready to write checks and knew nothing about startups in Seoul. And mm-hmm. I had a friend, Tim Che, who's now actually the head of investing at 500 Startups, who was really helpful and kind of encouraging us to do it, convincing me that we'd find enough deals and he'd help us a little bit with deal flow. And it was a fantastic experience. Yeah, it was really easy to find startups we were excited about. We actually ended up investing in 6 rather than the 5 we'd targeted. Mm-hmm. And it's gone tremendously well. And I'd say the majority of those companies are doing really well today. We go back to Seoul.
At least once, Matt.
Well, I mean, it's early, right? None of them are close to exits yet. So, I agree. It's better in terms of like, how are they all doing? It's better than I would have expected out of Silicon Valley, given the time that's passed. Yeah. So yeah, I think in general, the quality is really good over there.
So culturally, how did you find people different? You know, their tolerance for risk,
yeah,
the capital markets, because I think one of the things we have here in Silicon Valley is relatively There's a structured capital market, meaning there are people who do angel investing like you. There are Series A people, B, C, D. It's like a system here. But yeah, the market's not that well developed. So the
values
generally are low. Entrepreneurs give up more of their stake in the company. So tell us about the culture and the capital market there.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I would say is, so what's the tech culture like? So the traditional culture for people working on software stuff in Korea is pretty grim, right? It's to work at large companies like Samsung, mm-hmm. right? Inside these giant chaebol. And frankly, being a cog in a really huge machine that's pretty demoralizing and not a lot of fun, not a lot of creativity. So the traditional ways to work in computer stuff in Seoul are pretty grim. Not to say they're not, you know, good paying jobs, but they're not quite the freewheeling, feels like a university or a startup company stuff that we're used to in Silicon Valley. That said, that started to change a lot in the last 5 years, right? So in the last 5 years, we've seen a handful of tech companies in Seoul do incredibly well. Coupang, Naver, Kakao. And these are their internet companies, right? And this has all happened, right, basically in the last 5 years. So kind of out of nowhere, there's some pretty successful, pretty big tech startup companies that are doing really well. So it's early days, but there's already some really good exits, some cool things. But the VC scene, the sort of investing venture capital side of it, is still pretty early. I would say it's very different than Silicon Valley in a bunch of ways. One of the biggest is in Silicon Valley, when you go meet with Andreessen Horowitz or Sequoia Capital, you're meeting people whose background is mostly that they ran startup companies, right? They might have a finance degree from Harvard, but they also worked at a startup company and shipped some stuff. Maybe not a lot, maybe just 5 or 10 years, but there's some operator experience, right? They've been in the world themselves. Maybe not everyone, right? Maybe there's one or two partners at the firm who are more of a banker finance background, but most of them have been in a startup and they might've been marketing or sales or engineering or CEO, but they had some operational role. That's pretty rare in Seoul. So I think that's one of the biggest things they struggle with is when I talk to VCs in Seoul, they're mostly the banker types, right? It's finance people. They know the numbers. They don't know anything about technology. They don't know anything about products. So that's a challenging ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge, is that most of the people you're pitching to when you're trying to raise money in Korea have never been in a startup company themselves, mm-hmm. you know? So that's challenging. And then on the angel side, there are basically no angels, right? Since all the cool companies happened 5 years ago, right? Coupang, Naver, Kakao, those people haven't even started investing yet, right? So there's no one who does angel in Seoul. So we were kind of weird doing that, but it's not a common thing to see in Seoul at all. So that said, I think it's changing. Like mm-hmm. there are a bunch of people who did well at Naver who are going to now turn around and pay it forward and start to invest in other startups, both for financial reasons, but also just kind of because they want to pay it forward and they want to be part of what comes next. So I think it's early days, right? And I think the venture part is one of the challenges there, is that it's hard to get empathy from the person you're raising money from because they haven't really been in your situation before.
Yeah. And so what do people do? Let's say you and I are Koreans, we live in Korea and we want to do a startup. Like we have an idea and we need funding. What do people do?
There's a couple of good answers. There's a lot of good grants is one answer. So this never happens in the US, but in Korea, the government is pretty serious about supporting startups. So if you go out there and the VCs won't give you money, it is a viable option to go to the government and get them to give you money. And, you know, getting $50,000 or $100,000 from the government isn't that hard, actually. Yeah. If you have a good idea and you've got a prototype and stuff like that. So there's some other good sources of money. And I do think there's some accelerators. There's a bunch of accelerators, and accelerators can be a mixed bag. But I think if you're trying to get started and you can't get a major VC to do it, an accelerator can be a good way to get started and get some training and learn how the startup world works and get your first check. So I see a lot of startups in Korea that go in an accelerator, get $30,000, run for a year, then go to the government and raise $50,000, run for another year, right? Then go back to the VCs. And now they're 2 years old and their product is working a lot better. And now they can raise money. Yeah. Right now they can raise a proper seed round and raise more money. And now they're kind of getting inside the system and it's getting easier to explain it to the banker VCs because there's more here than just an idea and a good team. You've got a prototype, you have some early customers. So there's good paths to raising money, but I think it is challenging. There's definitely some communication and cultural issues around just who the VCs are and not having a lot of cross-pollination there yet. But I think it's changing. Mm. And it's good. I mean, there are some amazing companies. There's some really cool companies that are happening, and I'm sure there's a bunch that have happened since we're there. One thing we were also really impressed with is we went to Korea with an explicit goal that we wanted at least half the companies we invested in to be founded and run by women. We've been doing that with our US portfolio as well. So it wasn't new for us, but we went into Korea knowing, okay, we want to do this in Korea. And our expectation was this will be really hard, right? Like this is a very patriarchal society. There's probably not as many women with computer science degrees. We were predicting it might not be possible. It'd be really hard. It was actually surprisingly easy. I was amazed how many awesome companies we founded and run by women. So that was like a really wonderful surprise, actually. And some of our favorite entrepreneurs there are female founders who are running their own startups.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and it's cool. It's interesting. If you look at kind of the history of Silicon Valley, I think they're sort of that's happening earlier for them, which is kind of good. I mean, you would hope so, but it's kind of cool to see it playing out that way.
Yeah. I found in Sweden, when I was working there, the startups, when they would raise money, like they would give up 25%, 30% of the company for $100,000.
Yeah.
You know, it's shocking. Did you see things like that? Because, you know, entrepreneurs didn't really know how it works and they need money. Somebody's giving money. So they just, okay. Did you see things like that?
Definitely. And you definitely see startups where when you look at their cap table, it's just horrifying. And you're like, oh my God, guys, you don't even own your own company anymore. Like, so yeah, that sucks. And it does happen. I mean, the good news is the government grants don't take any equity. So that's the thing that can help is that if you can do a lot of government grants, you get money for your startup and they don't dilute you at all. So that's the one on the positive side, but on the negative side, you're right. And I think Korea is notorious for VCs who give horrible terms to startups. So you've got to be really careful, right? Yeah. You can't assume they're going to treat you well because they want to maintain a good founder-friendly reputation. I think a lot of VCs there don't really understand the idea of founder-friendly reputation yet.
So in Sweden also, they have two organizations, Vinnova and Almi. They give out grants. It sounds similar system.
Yep.
Did you see other thing? So I'm trying to draw comparison between, you know, Nordic countries and Seoul. I found the VCs I met there or investors in general, they have a banking mindset, meaning they want them to be profitable, like as soon as possible. And that, which is, you know, normal bankers, that's the type of investment they do, but venture is different. You need scale, market share depends on the type of business. You know, generally growth and profitabilities are competing and we tend to prioritize growth. Did you see that in Seoul? Like they want profitability?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that's what I mean by the banker mindset, right? Most VCs in Seoul have that banker background. They're expecting the earliest startups to already be profitable and to have 20-page business plans that are going to be accurate and all these expectations that are just totally ridiculous, right? Yeah, it's a big problem. So I think, you know, once you're at that phase, Seoul VCs do great, right? Like if you're at the phase where you're starting to be profitable or you're close to it, they can get their heads wrapped around it and they have money to invest. There's no shortage of money in VC funds there, but there's a reluctance to put it in the really early stuff.
Why do you think the Silicon Valley VCs are not going out and investing in Korea? Because you have talented people.
They are. Okay. They are. So they are like, so if you look at like C rounds in Korea, there's tons of US VCs piling into those, right? Like by the time a company is making money, US VCs jump into Korean deals all the time. And it's good because otherwise Korea wouldn't be able to fund some of these larger rounds. So it's good. But yeah, I have not seen US VCs participating in seed rounds and A rounds though. And I think there it's just it's a person power problem, right? It's just hard to do that. If you don't have someone on the ground in Seoul, how are you going to go find the deals and vet them and meet the teams? So there are US companies doing that really well in Seoul. One of my favorites is Tim Che's company, 500 Startups, right? They're doing a fabulous job in Seoul. Mm-hmm. And they run an accelerator, and a lot of those companies grow up and raise money from Korean VCs and US VCs. But in the earliest days when they need their first 25K check, 500 Startups is awesome in Korea.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a US fund, right? And they're operating in Korea and they're writing checks for Korean companies. Mm-hmm. And they're very founder friendly, right? They don't do rip off deal terms. And, you know, they're running it the same way they would run it in the US, which I think is why their reputation is so good and people like to work with them.
Yeah. And how, you know, in Silicon Valley, if I do a startup and it doesn't work, that's kind of when I look for a job, people see that as a positive. Okay. You know, he or she tried something. He must have learned something. So we want to hire that person. I found in Europe, generally, it's not the case. You failed, so that's like we don't want to be close to you because you failed. How is it in Korea?
I haven't had direct experience with that, honestly. So hard to say. Like, I don't know. I haven't had a direct experience where I've dealt with a second-time entrepreneur. That's a good... I think part of it is it's all so new, right? I don't know if there's that many out there yet.
Yeah.
It's a good question. I can't really speak to how investors see that or the people you're trying to hire would see that. Would they see that as a mark of failure, a mark of shame, or is that something you can, that's seen as a badge of honor like it is in Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question.
I was more asking because it's a risk. If I'm an entrepreneur and I, you know, start something that statistically most likely will fail, then I won't get a job. It just creates less entrepreneurs. If the culture is, you know, you try, it doesn't work, you learn something, then it just creates more entrepreneurs.
Yeah, certainly the entrepreneurs I saw don't seem demoralized when things go badly, right? They can certainly get bummed out when it's not going well, but I didn't see people being turned off by the difficulty level. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did anything surprise you in Korea about the culture?
In terms of the startup culture, it's very similar to Silicon Valley. It reminds me of Silicon Valley like 15 years ago. It's kind of like time travel. So I kind of love that. Like, it was neat looking back in time and kind of seeing like, and it gives me great confidence they're going to do really well, right? Like, it's a really, really cool country, really cool culture. They're exporting their culture. It's so darn cool, right?
Oh, K-pop, yeah.
K-pop, Hallyu. I mean, and I'm so into that stuff. So probably 30% of the music I listen to is K-pop or Korean music of one kind or another. I'm super confident in our investments in Korea and that country is going to continue to do super well.
Cool. So everything's great in Korea. Why did you decide to leave? And where did you go there?
Well, it was really, right, we were doing this gap year with our daughter, so it came with a time limit on it, so we were committed to come back to California. But we came back to California and just realized we still had the bug, the travel bug. And we were both, I don't know, my wife and I both grew up in Silicon Valley. We were pretty bored with it after spending 30 years working in it. And frustrated with some of the challenges I think Silicon Valley is going through right now, and the United States for that matter. So for us, we were excited to try something new. We did a short stint in France. It wasn't perfect for us, so we ended up going to Amsterdam. And so we've been in Amsterdam just actually getting close to a year and a half now. And we love it here in Amsterdam. The tech scene here is awesome. The investing scene is amazing. And the culture and the people are fantastic. So I think we're here to stay. I think we're here to stay.
So tell us more about the tech scene and startup scene in Amsterdam.
So it's much further along than Korea. It's a lot more like the US, I would say. But, you know, obviously not quite as mature in terms of being able to raise money or the community of people working in startups. So what are some of the challenges and differences here? I would say, so it's still early days for like successful tech startups, tech companies in Europe, actually, right? I think most people would be challenged to name an awesome successful tech company that's launched in Europe in the last 5 years, right? There are some, there's not a tremendous number, right? Like here in Amsterdam, there's booking.com, which is cool.
Yeah.
Very cool company. A lot of cool people came out of it. Not quite the scale of a Google or a Facebook though, but very successful considering it was one of the first big tech successes here. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got Wirecard in Germany now, like melting down
and,
and a miasma of fraud. So, you know, there's not a lot of like awesome success stories, right? Look in France too, right? Like, you know, there's Vivendi, I guess, but it's sort of just a big holding company for other stuff. Like, it's hard to point at something like Google or Facebook or NVIDIA in Europe, right? So we're still in the early days. There haven't been a lot of great successes. There's been some small ones. There haven't been huge ones. That is going to change, though, right?
Because Spotify, I would say, is one big one.
Spotify, that's a great example. Yeah, awesome company that I'm invested in. I love Spotify. Wow. But yeah, there's not as many as there should be, right?
Yeah. Like,
I think most of us would agree. So I think that the venture scene, the investing side of it here is certainly better than it, you know, more mature than it was in Seoul, but not quite what it is in the US. I do think that Europe is suffering from the same thing I described in Seoul, which is when you look at venture firms here, they're mostly full of banker types. And that's not awesome, right? By the time you get to the B or the C round, it's okay. It's not great. But when you're doing seed and A round, it's really not helpful. They don't get it. They're reluctant to take the risk. They don't understand the technology. And they want to see 20-page business plans for businesses that don't have any idea where they're going to be making money in 2 years. And nor should they, right? When Google started, they didn't know how they were going to make money. They didn't figure out the ad business till well after they raised many rounds of venture money. So the expectation is just unreasonable here in Europe. There are more angels here in Europe, so it is easier for companies to get off the ground, though, right? They can find a handful of people and get some early checks and get started. And there's also government money. So like in pretty much everywhere, aside from the United States, there's also ways that the government or the or Europe can put money into your company. But there are angels as well. So I would say it's a lot more like Silicon Valley, but you know, some challenges, some quirks.
When you say Europe, Matt, do people think of like Europe as one place, or, you know, the Dutch investors invest in Dutch companies, French in French, because within Europe, you know, there are many different cultures, languages, and history. Is it actually like Europe, or it's, you know, smaller ecosystems?
That's a great question. I think when you get to B rounds and beyond, people invest across borders, and they all say they invest across borders. But what I've seen for the earliest stages for seed and A is that it's mostly in country in practice, right? And they're all willing to invest across border, but their networks are local and there's language and culture issues. So in practice, it usually ends up being pretty local for the first couple rounds. I mean, the other thing about Europe, right, is it's not like tech is taking off all over Europe. There are a handful of cities in Europe where tech is doing really well, right?
Yeah.
I can't stress this strongly enough, right? Like doing a tech startup in Munich is very challenging, right? Doing a tech startup in Berlin is pretty great from what I hear. You know, so the short list of cities that I know are doing really well are like Madrid, Amsterdam, obviously London, Malmo, Stockholm, Berlin, but now I start running out of cities, right? I've probably forgotten one or two, but there's not a lot more. So that's the one thing to say, is it's not like it's universally awesome all across Europe. There's little pockets where it's going really well. Which is not unlike the US, right? Same thing's true in the US, right? There's a handful of cities in the US where it's all going really well. And it's great places to raise money, but there's lots of parts of the US where you'd be pretty hard pressed to get your first check or your second check.
Yeah. Listening to you, it, you know, feels like I should raise a fund and just invest in Amsterdam and Seoul.
It's like they're both really great. I think here in Europe, and particularly in Amsterdam, one of the things that we're really excited about is green and clean tech stuff, right? So in the US, there's almost no interesting investments in green or clean tech. Nothing gets funded. There's some interesting historical reasons for that and policy reasons for that. But in Europe, it's going great. There's tons of startups that are, and in fact, we just invested in a VC fund here that's focused entirely on clean tech stuff. So there's tons of investment happening. Europe is super committed to it. I think there's a lot of money to be made doing startups and investing in startups here in Europe that are going after clean tech. Because, right, if we don't sort this out, right, we're all gonna bake to death.
Yeah.
So we got to figure it out. So I'm really impressed that Europe is the only place I see these investments happening. And I think there's huge opportunities here, right? There's across the world, whether it's in Asia, the US, Europe, people are going to need to pay for clean tech solutions, for green solutions. Europe's way ahead on building those companies. I think 10 years from now, Europe's going to be the leader in selling solutions for that stuff, right? So we're at the early days. It's still fairly high risk investing, but I think there's someone's got to build this technology, and Europe is the one that's investing.
Yeah, I think for these really long range things like, you know, energy efficiency, non-carbon energy sources, when government policy helps, then people are more inclined to invest.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and in the US, it's been a disaster, right? Like the government's not helping at all with policy, obviously, if anything, going the other direction. It's also interesting in the US, part of it is just historical problem, right? Is 10 years ago, Silicon Valley got really excited about clean tech investing, right? You probably remember this. A lot of the luminaries started funds and they all crashed and burned and didn't make money. And part of it was they never got any policy support, which they're very salty about. But it's also meant that every time a venture person in Silicon Valley wants to do clean tech now, everyone else is like, yeah, no, not doing that again, never again. Which is a ridiculous reason not to do it, but it's, you know, it's hard to get over the scar tissue, right? You got burned last time you tried to use the stove, so it's really hard to talk yourself into using the stove again.
Yeah, which you would think is counterintuitive because VCs are supposed to, you know, be... They understand risk. They should know better. But
they're also human beings. And if they tried it and got burned, they're not going to want to try again without some pretty strong reassurances, none of which they're getting from the current administration. So that's not a very conducive time to investing in this stuff in the US. But it's good for Europe. It's a huge opportunity. I think Europe is really serious about that. And I see these companies all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are two things I want to say about Holland, which have, you know, influenced me. The whole tech world works on semiconductor. The foundation of tech is semis. And beneath that are the companies that make semiconductor manufacturing equipment. And the most advanced company in the world for that is ASML, which is a Dutch company.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
yeah. Cool. Like if that goes away, like I tell you, the progress will stop. It'll take so many years for others to catch up. So all these, you know, 7-nanometer chips you hear about, like all that is coming out of ASML, which is Dutch. So there is behind the scenes things happening. Can they sell to China because US banned, you know, American technology going to China. So it's behind the scenes, Dutch has a, you know, big place in the tech world, which we don't hear about it.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't mean to undersell the like technology in Europe. There's some great examples in robotics too, right? Some of the best robotics companies are actually in Sweden, right? Mm-hmm. There's some amazing robotics here. What's missing here is that there aren't a lot of robotics startup companies or... semiconductor manufacturing startup companies. There's definitely some tech behemoths, but they're not the small agile startups founded in the last few years.
Yeah, it's like what we are talking about is a startup scene that's different than, you know, tech scene in general where big companies are playing a role.
Yep.
I have a good friend in Holland, Maxim, And he kind of changed my mind, like put me in the life trajectory by just asking me a simple question. I used to work at T-Mobile in marketing. You know, I had a big marketing budget and you're doing, you know, marketing things. And then he asked me a very simple question, which somehow being in marketing, I didn't think deeply about, was how do you change consumer behavior? And I was like, wow, like I didn't have a well thought out answer. So I, you know, studied, and then I got into diffusion of innovations. I started observing human behavior. I started a blog. All that was because Maxim asked me a question, how do you change consumer behavior? So that's also why, you know, I love Holland. You know, I like going there. People are very, and first time, he lives in a suburb of Amsterdam called Haarlem.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I've been to Amsterdam many times, but first time I went to Haarlem to his place, I think 2-3 years ago. And I was the shortest person there. I'm 6 feet. And like, it feels so odd looking up at people talking because you're not used to it.
People are ginormous here. Yep.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. My wife is enjoying it. As you know, she's 6 feet tall, so she's enjoying being average here. Not that she'll ever be average, but she's not the tallest anymore.
And she's also investing with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been working on it together for about 2.5 years now, which has been a lot of fun. It's pretty cool.
How is it like working with your wife?
It's really good. I mean, we see eye to eye on a lot of this stuff, and we've talked about it on and off through the years, but like, it's only the last couple of years where we spend a lot of our time together working on it. It's been tremendously fun. I really like meeting entrepreneurs together, talking about these ideas. It's worked out really well. I think it's always a little fraught when you're talking about working with a spouse, but it's gone super well. I have nothing but positive things to say. It's been really cool. And I think part of it for me is that prior to that, I was doing all of our investing stuff myself with no partner. So I think part of it is just having a partner is a revelation.
Yeah.
She is the best possible partner. So I'm really enjoying working on it with her. And I think it's deepened our relationship. It's been really positive.
That's great. And you're growing a beard? Because
I am. It's getting pretty epic. Yeah, I've got quite a COVID beard going on here. So I figure when they come up with a cure for this, maybe I'll cut it off. But I don't know. Might be a while, it looks like.
So how is it like working now in COVID times, investing, meeting entrepreneurs? How are you managing that?
That's a good question. I mean, in terms of the work at my startup, it's me working by myself. So it hasn't really impacted me too much. But it is... It's been disruptive because it was, yeah, there's definitely a period where I didn't want to go into my office because I didn't want the exposure of interacting with people in and out of the building. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely an issue. In terms of meeting entrepreneurs, we're just doing it all over Zoom. So it actually hasn't really slowed us down at all. And the truth is a lot of the pitches happened over Zoom anyway. So it hasn't really changed much, honestly, for two of us running investing out of our house in our spare time. It hasn't really been that big a difference. Like, yeah, there are meetings that we would have done in person that we now do in Zoom instead, but it hasn't really been that big a deal. And that's what I'm hearing from friends across the investing world, right? It doesn't actually seem to really be slowing things down very much.
Wow, that's good to hear. It's good for entrepreneurs that the investors, you know, are not slowing things down because of COVID. Yeah. How do you filter the pitches? Meaning, you know, in Silicon Valley, people are very optimistic. Everybody's changing the world. And the Dutch, I noticed, are very direct and, you know, they don't exaggerate. And maybe, how do you filter that? Because you... Here, pitch here versus there, I can bet they're completely different.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. That's a good question. I think I think a lot of the stuff that we are investing in is early stage, like early, we're usually the first check-in, not always, but usually, so early seed stage stuff. For that stuff, the truth is that level of like polish and bullshit and exaggeration is really out of place, right? Like if someone came in being super over the top exaggerating, I'd never fund them, right? Because in that early stage, right, it's really about investing in a team, like 1, 2, 3 people who are fired up, aimed at the right problem, have good ideas. If they come in with a really ridiculously over the top thing, we're going to pass anyway. So I think actually for the stage that we're at, that isn't the right kind of showmanship and stuff. I think you see that stuff coming to the fore more when you're in like the B round and the C round, right? Even A round, right? When there's kind of, there is a bit of a profitable business there, but you got to pitch it big, right? What you don't want is for your investor to think, oh, they're just going to build a car. No, we're building an autonomous car with robots and lasers, right? Like, right. Cause then you're trying to pitch market size, right? So I would say like in a B round in particular, you're pitching market size, right? You're trying to avoid being pigeonholed into being just this business that you have today, convince people that it's going to be very, very big, right? I mean, a good example would be like Google, right? Like they had an advertising business, but when they first were doing web ads, it was not a very profitable field because companies weren't spending that much money advertising on the web, right? To get investors excited, I would imagine back in the day, you'd have to pitch this market is going to grow, right? That's the real pitch, is not that we're going to win in the internet advertising market, which is tiny. The whole market is going to grow. We're dominating this and it's strategic because it's going to become the majority of the advertising market, which it now is, right? So I think that the phase we're at, that kind of like over the top exaggeration stuff doesn't work anyway. So it hasn't really impacted us, but it's a good point. It's interesting. I wonder if people have trouble here in the B round. I bet they do actually. Cause you're right. People don't exaggerate. They yeah. don't. They're kind of on that kind of thing.
Because you are an engineer. That style of pitching would work better for you, I think.
I agree. I'm more of a like, tell me the truth kind of person anyway.
Yeah.
So I think I really like that about the Dutch. Yeah. They are very direct. Yeah. Painfully direct at times, but I kind of love it.
Yeah, I noticed. So I have another good friend who's from Holland, Sylvie. You know, I go to south of France almost every year, except this year. So I see her every year, and she has her own real estate business. How she pitches, talks about her business. I said, well, you gotta, you know, if you're trying to raise money, you have to say. She said, no, that I don't know that. I said, well. So I can't really, how their personality is, you can't ask them to exaggerate. They say what, you know, they believe is 100% accurate. Yeah. Any final thoughts for entrepreneurs in Europe? How, when they talk to you, what are the kind of things you and other early stage investors look for in addition to team, like, you know, so that they're more prepared.
I would mostly encourage people to actually do climate change stuff, right? Like, I think that is going to just be huge. And I think there's a lot of money to be made solving that problem, and we have to solve it. And some of the money is going to come from governments, but lots is going to come from investors. And at the end of the day, it's consumers and big companies that are going to pay for the products that solve this problem. So, you know, there's plenty of money to be made doing this stuff. So I'd really encourage people to go into that field. And I think a lot of people in tech don't think of themselves as being someone who could be a green entrepreneur or a climate change entrepreneur. But I don't think that's true. A lot of the products that we have to build are just software, right? Like there's a lot of interesting work to be done in this area. So I'd encourage people to look at that. I think that's going to be huge. And Europe is very committed to it.
Mm-hmm. Great. I think I can, as you know, can talk to you for hours. But we promise we'll keep it around an hour. So thank you very much again, Matt, for joining us. Fun. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I did as well. Thank you, Chandler.
Yeah, I hope we do it soon again and hopefully in person. I remember last year I saw you in Amsterdam. It was so much fun, you and Erica. So I hope I see you in person soon again.
Me too. I hope we get this pandemic under control.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you. Glad to help. Glad to be part of it.
Thanks. See you next week, everybody. Bye.